Okay, so some of the material here should be familiar to those of you in Reichersbergshire.
He hasn't been here in a while.
I know, but I know he did these sources a while ago. Some of them, not all of them. I said some of these should be familiar. We left off with a question yesterday, which I figured we had to address before we move on to Menachot stuff. Maybe we'll do one more day on Hanukkah. On Hanukkah, on Purim. Now you confused me. But we left off with the following question, which is that there's a fundamental machloket, Rishonim, whether chinuch is a mitzvah that devolves on the parent or on the child. And then we yesterday talked about the different ways you could conceptualize the obligation on the child, whether it's to do the act, contract work, or an internship, or a co-op, or masha, yeah? You can take a leaf out of his book. This is what he did, too. And then we saw even within the Ritva that the Ritva was willing to say that in theory the rabbis can obligate you directly in mitzvah, but that's not always how they did it, but conceptually thinks that it's a they think it's a possibility. But what we noted was that there's a fundamental problem, which is logically it is perfectly coherent for the rabbis to obligate parents to educate their children, because whatever it is that obligates people to listen to the rabbis, that same thing can obligate them to listen to the rabbis when they say educate your children. That was about as vague as I could go, but yes? Right? Meaning, however we're going to justify, and that's what we'll have to focus on, the fact that the rabbis can tell you what to do. Among the things they can tell you what to do is educate your children. But what about children? Right? Children, by what right do the rabbis tell them what to do? If God said they are exempt from mitzvot, so then they are exempt from mitzvot.
It's almost like the opposite. Like, the Torah tells, gives the rabbis, right, the right to enforce other mitzvot. And at the same time, the Torah says you cannot enforce it for children.
Right.
It's not even meaning, usual. Right. It's like the exact opposite.
Meaning, children are not chayav mitzvot. And therefore, if you think that rabbinic power emerges from a mitzvah, then since children aren't obligated in the mitzvah, there is no source for the rabbis to obligate them.
Unless you say that the rabbinic obligation is not coming. They can enforce you not from the... Meaning, they're enforcing you just because the rabbis, not
good.
The Torah gives them the...
But then you've got to figure out, so where did that power come from? And that's why I said we have to deal with that problem. And I said, those of you who are in a Reichersbergshire, I know he dealt with this problem, not in the context of chinuch.
Yeah.
But in chinuch is one of the... One of chinuch, the mitzvah to educate your children, which we talked about yesterday. This is one of the... How do you even say this? One of the... It's definitely not one of the loci classicus, I guess. Loci. Locus classicus would be like... Okay, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. I'm not going to try to conjugate Latin. I know Latin well enough. By which I mean I know like a few phrases which my Rebbein used over and over again. Locus classicus being one of them. Locus classicus is like the primary place that you ask that an issue comes up. Right? Locus meaning just line, classicus. Classic. Right? Okay. So, but in order to understand this, we have to just do a very basic survey of where does rabbinic authority come from so we can understand the problem here. And not only do I know Roy Hirschberg did it, but when I gave a share and mentioned this when I was here for Shabbos, some of you even acknowledged remembering learning this. So if you've forgotten it by now, then you have violated all the Isurim in the Gemara against forgetting Talmud Torah.
We didn't do that one yet, did we?
I did it. I got it to share.
That's not fair.
Yes. Sorry. It's online. But listen to it when you exercise or something.
Yeah. Because I listen to share when I exercise.
You don't? It's a great time.
When you come to 35, do you also like...
I don't know. Is that like a motivational?
Do you share while you...
When I come... What do you mean?
You sometimes come to 35 to exercise a little bit.
Yeah, I usually listen to share.
Sorry.
Yeah, of course. I listen to share while I exercise. Well, depends. I haven't been listening to Sherm while I'm exercising recently because I've taken to
sleep, you know?
Depending on what I'm doing, if I'm working out, so I'm like stationary enough that if I position my Yerushalmi in the right way, I can just learn Yerushalmi. So that's been my what I've been doing right now. So like,
just imagining you bench pressing with like a huge.
So that's that I couldn't do, right? I don't have bench, but you can do most things, right? Like anything where you're oriented straight or down.
Yerushalmi curls.
Yeah. First of all, that's how I felt going to Amud Dim because I had two of the Yerushalmis, like it's like two of these, and I was holding them and reading them as I was walking, and like my biceps were like, oh, because like 25 pounds, it's like, you know, and I was walking to 20 minutes, you know. It's not really a 20-minute walk, but if you're holding two Yerushalmis and trying to read while walking, it is indeed a 20-minute walk.
White.
What?
White.
Because I was returning one, and I was learning one, so. So I had... But I finished Demai, so I had Demai on the bottom and I was reading Kilayim on the top. It was much easier on the way back, where I just had Kilayim. It was great. See, this was a mistake, was that I committed to doing two blot a day of Yerushalmi. So like it is a lot, so like I have to like find time for it. We'll see how long I go. And I'm at this point, yeah. It's been good. It's been good.
Have you gone through before?
No, that's why I'm doing it now. So if I do two blot a day, a little bit more, so then I should finish in 2 years.
Is it a similar style, or...?
No, it's different. Oh. I mean, I've learned Yerushalmi before. I've never gone through all of it. So like, I'm somewhat familiar with it. I had a conversation with Jeremy McGenzie every Friday on the Yerushalmi.
Nice.
Yeah, we went through a few mezechtas over the years I was in Toronto. Okay. So what is the source of rabbinic power? And let's see if it works for chinuch. Again, I'm not giving an exhaustive share on rabbinic power. I want to focus on just the question we're doing because I feel like I at least need to close up those loose ends. So the main source in the Gemara, in the context of Chanukah, for where does rabbinic power come from, is the following passage, Maim Bevarech. The Gemara is asking, what bracha do you make on lighting the Hanukkah candles? So the Gemara says, Mevarech Hasher Kedishanu Tutav V'Tzivanu L'Hadlak Ner Shel Chanukah. The bracha that we all make.
Right, but God didn't.
And then the Gemara says what Daniel says, and thank you, I knew you remember this, Heichan Tzivanu. You don't have one?
No.
I can send another one to Prince, or you can follow it. Heichan Tzivanu, where did God command us that we can say, blessed is God who commanded us? So Rav Avya Amar Milot Asur, Rav Avya said, from the Pasuk of, do not turn stray. Rav Nechemya Amar Shalavicha V'yagedcha V'zekenecha V'yam Rulach. So, what's the problem? In context, in the Pesukim, what does Lo Tasur tell us? We talked about this when I was here for Shabbos.
Do not stray from the right path.
No, it does. It talks about rabbinic authority, but what type of rabbinic authority?
You go and ask them a question.
Right, or what we talked about, if you remember on Shabbos, interpretive authority. Meaning, when you have a question about what the Torah means in a particular law, let's say interpretive / juridical authority. Okay, that's a fancy way of saying interpretive, meaning they have the right to interpret the Torah. Juridical, meaning if you have a case in law, an actual case law, right? Jury, right? Judicial contexts. Okay. Number two, that's where it comes from. Kipalei mimcha davar lamishpat beinam ledam beinin ledin uveinega lanega divrei rivot b'sharacha v'kamta v'alita l'makom asher yivchar Adonai Elohecha bo. If you have a doubt in monetary law, in ritual law, so you go to the place that God has chosen, in Beit HaMikdash, the Sanhedrin sit there in the chamber of hewn stone. The Lishkat HaGazit in English, in Hebrew. In English, the chamber of hewn stone. Which also sounds very nice. There's a nice ring to it. Uvatala kohanim alivim v'lashov feit asher yeh b'yam imahem v'darashta v'yigidu l'charet bar mishpat. So you'll come to the kohanim, the levim, the judge who's in that day, and you'll ask, and he'll tell you the law. Va'asita piyad davar she'yigid l'cham en ha'makom ahu asher yivchar Adonai v'shamart la'asot b'chol yashir rucha. And then you will do what they say. Al piyad Torah she'yir yorucha v'al mishpat asher yomim l'cha ta'aseh lo tasur min ha'davar she'yigid l'cha yamin u'smal. Listen to what they say. Don't stray left or right.
Right or left.
Don't do that either. Right or left. Left or right. What if they tell you to do the wrong thing?
Do the wrong thing. Actually says to do the wrong thing.
Rashi says, do the wrong thing. Good. That's against the Bavli and the Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi... What? No, you're right. Rashi says that. Rashi, as our version has it, says, even if they tell you right is left, left is right. The Yerushalmi says explicitly, Yachal, afil morim l'chal yamin shu esmol v'as moshe amin. I might have thought, even if they say left is right and right is left, you'd be wrong. Talmud lomar l'alachet yamin u'smol. Rakim morim l'chal yamin shu yamin v'as moshe u'smol. So the Yerushalmi at the beginning of Hurriya. There are a lot of problems with the Yerushalmi, starting with the fact that it quotes a pasuk that doesn't exist. L'alachet yamin u'smol is not what it says in the pasuk.
Where does Rashi get his...
So there are different gersot of the Rashi, and it appears in a Sifrei in different gersot. So it's one version of a Rashi within one gersot of a Sifrei.
Okay.
Yeah. The Bavli also seems to go against it, but that's a share for another time. I committed to myself that I'm going to limit myself to the local question I wanted to answer. I think. I'll try. And then the continuation is that if you have a member of the Sanhedrin, or someone who's worthy of being the Sanhedrin, who... doesn't follow the rabbis, so then kill it. That's called Zaken Mamre, the rebellious elder. So, simple pshat of the psukim. Lo Tasur tells you, you must listen to the rabbis under what circumstances?
You ask them a question.
You ask them a question. Evidence. Interpretive, judicial scenario. What about legislative power? Does this indicate anything about legislative power?
Kind
of. Nothing.
Well,
absolutely nothing.
By interpreting, it's some sort of legislation.
No, it's not. Interpretation is interpretation. Legislation is legislation. In American law, who gets to interpret? Who gets to legislate?
Court interprets.
The court interprets.
The Congress.
The Congress legislates.
Okay, but
by legislates mean that they
legislate is create law. Interpret is understand pre-existing law.
Well, wouldn't you say that?
No.
I didn't ask a question yet.
The answer is no. What do we call it when a judge legislates? There's a phrase for it, which is very derogatory.
Judicial review.
No, it's called legislating from the bench, which is an insult that we levy against judges who aren't doing their job, right? Who are trying to, who are not really interpreting, they're interpreting in a way that's clearly a new law. This is literally the machloket in America, right? Judicial, right? Conservative judges are very obsessed with not legislating from the bench, and liberal judges tend to not care as much, right? They tend to view that as, well, they'll tell you that they believe in loose interpretation, and if a conservative judicial legal thinker is insulting them, they'll say that's not a creative interpretation, that's legislation from the bench, right? Is that you're trying to usurp the power of the court. To legislate, it's not your job. Now ask your question, now that I've had a rant about American law. Yeah?
Like, are they officially conservative?
No, they don't have official positions, but, like, depending on how they...
No, no, I mean conservative
cases,
in terms of thought.
In terms of the
way they think. I mean, conservatives tends to be more...
Yeah.
Because they're conservatives, small c, right, they are originalists. They care more about the original interpretation. They're just... Now, again, you can both... Even liberal judges should believe that they're just interpreting. They might just think you have a wider latitude in what counts as interpretation, meaning you might not have to care about originalism, right? You might be able to interpret the words, but not necessarily the original intent, which gives you freedom. But that's a far cry from straight up, you know, pretending. Like what the Israeli courts do is legislation from the bench. Okay, that's hard to deny because the Israeli courts believe they have the power to overrule basic laws, which is the equivalent of our constitution, which is definitionally impossible.
No constitution.
But they do it anyways. Our closest
no
we have
restrictions on that.
No, the closest we have is basic laws. Basic laws are what they sound like. Basic laws, right? Fundamental laws.
But they can
overturn it, which they can't. But they're doing it anyways.
Example,
welcome to the chaos.
Example of a basic law in Israel would be
Chok HaShvut. The law that any Jew who wants to make aliyah gets automatic citizenship. That's a basic law. Right? There are certain basic laws in Israel.
Don't kill.
What's not a basic law? It is a basic law of all of society. It's not a chok yisod in the formal sense of the Israeli chokei yisod. I don't know all the chokei yisod. There aren't so many. It's also weird because you need 61 members of Knesset to pass a Chuk Yesod, meaning you can pass the Constitution the exact same way you can pass a bill. It's very strange. Very strange system. But that doesn't mean that judges should be able to change them. That's a different story. The most controversial ones that always create tension are the basic law of human rights and versus the basic law of the Jewish state. Right? Meaning because the human rights, the basic law of human rights theoretically grants equality to all people regardless of religion, but the definition of Israel as a Jewish state grants certain benefits to Judaism as a religion and Jews as people. So a lot of the times what the Supreme Court is doing is trying to deal with potential contradictions between those basic laws. But that's Israeli, that's problems in Israeli law. My point is that fundamentally, a judge's job is not legislation, it's interpretation. And that's what a judge does. They interpret pre-existing law and they apply it to case law. So where do we get the source for rabbinic legislative power to create law? Which, remember, the Gemara had argued that where does Hanukkah come from, which is clearly a case of rabbinic legislation, and quoted Lo Tasur.
But that doesn't make sense.
Good. So now what do? So you have two options. You can either say, you're right, it doesn't emerge directly from the psukim, but the same psukim that grant rabbis interpretive power, grant them legislative power. That's what the Gemara says. That's what it means. How do we get there? Come up with a logical argument. Something like, if God trusted them to interpret his laws, then he probably trusted them to make laws too, or something like
that's
that.
That's a terrible argument.
Fine. But who takes the argument that, in fact, rabbis, as the simple Pshat of the Gemara would indicate, have legislative power based on this pasuk? What? I mean, who understands the Gemara simply? Which, just continuing the sources, it's really in order here. The Rambam, right? Maimonides. The Rambam thinks consistently, Lo Tasur is the source of rabbinic legislative power. So I gave you, for example, number three, HaMitzvah Shin Yubed, He Shizharnu Mechalok Al Balei Kabbalah Aleihem Shalom U'matzata Mimitzvatam Maaseh Torah. The 312th mitzvah is to not argue with the rabbis, the Balei HaKabbalah. And if you look at number four, and he tells you what is included in with this, is the Dvarim Shigazru Chachamim Nevi'im Shebechol Dor V'Dor La'asot Siag La'Torah, all the things that they instituted in each generation, V'chein Yitba'er Me'em HaMinhagot, HaTakanot, Shetkinu, all the customs, all the decrees, all the obligations that the rabbis gave you, all emerge from Lotasur Min HaDavar, right, short line, who disagrees? Many people, but who disagrees? The Ramban, very good. How'd you guess? Right, the Ramban disagrees, and he says, "What are you talking about?" Hadavar habarur haminukem mikol shibush, who should know dia she'ein alacha hazed lo tasur l'mash amru befirushay haTorah. It is beyond a shadow of a doubt that the only thing that emerges from Latasur is interpretive power. Interpretive power. Perushei HaTorah.
So what does he say?
Torah Zera Shavel Vinyan Abu Shar Bahen. Oh, Mashma La Shona Katub Atzmo. Whether it be the exegete, right, the 13 hermeneutical principles or the 36 hermeneutical principles.
36.
Yeah, Rabbi Yossi Ben Galili was 36. Rabbi Shmuel was 13. Rabbi was 36. Or halachah Moshe Mi-Sinai, etc. But legislative power does not come from Lo Tasur. I just gave you in 6 that the Ritva, according to most people, Lo Tasur, whatever it means, applies to like the centralized courts, maybe Chazal, and that's a story for another time. How do we get to the Bavli? But probably not your local rabbi, but the Ravid is quoted by the Ritva is actually saying it's your local Orthodox rabbi too. He is also imbued with the power of Lo Tasur, which is a story in its own right. But now let me ask you the question.
But it says, you should, if you have a question, go to... It was... Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So now let's ask the fundamental question. Very good. According to the Rambam, the problem I have is that's not what the Torah means. How did you expand it? According to the Ramban, I have a bigger problem, which is, at least according to the Rambam, I have a biblical source. How I got to that biblical source is a bit interesting. But according to the Ramban, he just says, yeah, you know, it's not from the Torah. End of story. Where is it from? Why do we listen to the rabbis? He just leaves this an open question. Like, you know, it's obvious, right? It's not from Lotusser, it just is. So where does it come from? Good, guys in Ray Hirschberg, sure, tell me.
Torah,
where does it come from?
Sinai.
That's very nice, that's convenient. Very convenient, yeah? Great, where does it come from?
The Mishnah.
I don't know, where does it come from? So give me models. Come on. You go to Roy Hirschberg, sure. I don't. You didn't earlier in the year. I don't know. You've gone for 2 years, haven't you?
No.
Oh, God. So you guys didn't go. So then I really should have printed out everything from him. I only put minimal sources.
I got it.
Good. So you tell me.
Tell you what.
Give me possibilities. Where does it come from? If it's not from the Torah, where is it?
I mean, I don't know. The Rambam said Kabbalah, so it's just brought down.
The Rambam doesn't agree.
Tradition.
Yeah.
I mean, it could just be that they're, well-learned people, so you trust them making svaras about the Torah and, like, interpreting things for you because you think they know more than you understand it better.
Good. So, one possibility is to say, I don't need a source. They're smart. They intuit what God wants. This is basically what Rav Hanan says in a wild passage. But he says it much more strongly than you, which is, it's not just that I trust them. It's that they obviously are able to intuit God's will, even when it's not in the Torah. Right? When you say you trust them, it means the way he formulates it is quite radical. And we'll read it inside. He says, here's how it is. We trust these people to interpret the Torah, and therefore we also trust that they are capable of intuiting what God wanted, even though he didn't write it in the Torah. We know that they are correct.
That's a step up.
And therefore, why are you obligated to listen to them? The same reason you're obligated to listen to the Torah, which is you're obligated to listen to God. And there's two ways God made his will known in the world. The Torah. Or the rabbis, he actually says three. The Torah, Nevuah, and the rabbis. Those are just three different ways in which God made his will known to the world. And the reason that you're obligated is because you're obligated to listen to what God said. That's just the way the world works.
But then how do you have any machloket or anything?
Machloket is what God wants. Okay. Well, let's read it inside. Now, you should ask me a few questions, which is, okay, first of all, what? Second of all, and therefore, why is there a difference between biblical law and rabbinic law? Meaning, if all of it is just God said so, so now what? Now, that question might exist for the Rambam also, which is what the Ramban asked, which is, wait, if all rabbinic law is biblical, why is there a difference between biblical and rabbinic law? The answer to that is because rabbinic law is imposed by the rabbis, the obligation is to listen to the rabbis. It's not that each individual rabbinic law takes on the status of a biblical law. It's that the general category does, but the individual act is rabbinic in nature. Or the rabbis chose to treat their laws differently than biblical laws to distinguish between their word and the word of God directly. According to the Ramban, what are you going to say if Rav Hanan is right? So he'll have to say, yes, it's true that everything is from God. But the fact that God didn't write it in the Torah means that God wanted it to exist, but at a weaker level. That's what you're going to have to say. Now, why is this going to help us for Chinuch? Why did I bring this up in Chinuch? Because, as I said, let's just go through the logical argument here. According to the Rambam, should rabbis be able to directly obligate children in mitzvot?
Yes.
According to the Rambam. No, because what do they need to obligate children? Obligate anyone? A chiyuv in mitzvot. Lotasur. Are children chayiv in lotasur?
According to the Rambam, the rabbi's authority
comes from lotasur.
Right, but it's also stronger than just saying they're smart.
No, but their authority comes from a pasuk. And are kids obligated in the Torah yet?
No.
So by what authority do the rabbis have power over them? They need the Torah. They need a pre-existing obligation to the Torah to invoke that obligation. Now, what's the only way you could save? Now, according to the Rambam, you could just say maybe he agrees with Rashi that they never tried to obligate the children; they obligated the parents. You could save the possibility of the Rambam and still think that the kids are directly obligated, but that would take some fancy lumdus moves. What would you have to say? And I didn't give you sources on this, so I'll say it outside. What would you have to say?
You would have to say that...
Logically. You have to say something very fancy lumdishly, and that is?
The rabbis have the power to obligate.
No, that would be really fancy. That I wouldn't buy. Because the Rambam, it has to come to Lodusser. What would you have to say? I'm working on the assumption
it's
that...
It's a lower level.
I'm working on the assumption that kids are not chayiv in the mitzvah. It could be I'm wrong. It could be the kids are chayiv in the mitzvah.
Just not in the punishment.
They're just patur from unction. Very good. Right? Is you'd have to say, maybe kids actually in Shamayim become obligated in mitzvot. It's just that they don't get punished on earth. Like, the courts can't punish them. But God can. Right? There is an Avera, and there are Achronim who go in this direction. The Chassam Sofer and the Yehuda suggest that when we say that, you know, you're not chayiv in mitzvah until you're bar mitzvah, it's not true. It just means we don't punish you. As soon as you're smart enough to understand the mitzvah, God will take it out in you. The courts can't impose it. But you start becoming liable as soon as you are smart enough to understand the consequences of what you are doing. If that's at 5, it's at 5. If it's at 6, it's at 6. If it's at 8, it's at 8. If it's at 9, it's 9. If it's at 13, it's at 13. But fundamentally, you are chayiv. Now, if that's the case, you could construct an argument and say that that's what's going on. Is that a katan sheigil chinuch? It's educated, right, the age of education. That means that in a
what a kid's smart enough to understand what's going on,
and therefore he's chayiv in mitzvot. It's just there's no onesh, but therefore the rabbis can obligate him. Right. Now that's what you could say. It's again, it's very fancy. The Maariv Chiyas notes it's quite problematic because the majority position is actually the opposite. Right, the majority position, which the Rambam quotes in the 7th Parak of Perashat Mishnayot and Sanhedrin from the Yerushalmi, is that in terms of consequences in court, you become liable at what age? 13. Bar mitzvah. Yeah. In Shamayim, what age do you become liable? 20. Right? The main view in Chazal seems to be the opposite. Right? Which is that you become liable in heaven later than you become liable on earth. Their source being what? What's the source of the Yerushalmi?
The Tzavat.
Close. The Meraglim. Right? The fact that the only Jews who were punished for the sin of the Meraglim were people who were above 20. Right? Which the Yerushalmi uses evidence that God doesn't punish until 20. So I'm not going to focus too much on this direction. I've never seen anyone actually say explicitly what I just said, which is that the way to justify the Rambam, if you wanted to combine it with Rashi, meaning think that rabbinic power comes from Lotasur and think that the nature of chinuch was that the child was directly obligated, was by saying that children are chayiv in mitzvot. I've never seen someone make that particular calculus. That is a possible direction. Again, I didn't want to go give you like overly complicated tshuva than the Chacham Sofer on this. This does get a little bit complicated. One of the proofs for this is a Gemara in Sanhedrin Daf Nun Hey, which seems to say that for a katan who violates an isur, there is a ma'aseh avera, but they don't get punished because God had mercy on them, which seems to indicate that there is a ma'aseh avera recognized, even if there's no onesh, which is not quite the same as Nodi Yehuda, because that doesn't mean they're chayiv, it just means that the avera sort of exists metaphysically. It exists, so it doesn't get you quite there. It also, it's complicated because it's a contradiction, because one Gemara sounds that way, another Gemara sounds a different way. Gemara Nivama Lama Gimel sounds different. This gets into very complicated lumdus that goes on forever. But the simplest way of understanding it is that if you hold like the Rambam, that rabbinic power comes from Lotasur, then you should understand like Rashi that chinuch is on the parent, because the children cannot be obligated by the rabbis, right, without Lo Tassur. And therefore, if you think that children are directly obligated, you have to come up with some model that is explainable even for people who are not yet chayav in the Torah. And basically that analysis that I just made is what I gave you from Rav Elchanan in number 7. Rav Elchanan Wasserman has this very interesting little book. It's in the middle of Kovetz Yerim. It's a 5-chapter little pamphlet called Kuntres Divrei Sofrim, which is exactly what it sounds like, a pamphlet that discusses the nature of rabbinic law. And in the first chapter, he gets into this question, specifically applying it to Chinuch. That's really the part that I bolded here. But let's read through it. No, I want to read through all of it, but the Chinuch part I bolded. The theory is here. I want to read it a little bit more extensively than maybe you have in the past. V'tema gdola lomar kein. He's commenting on the Ramban. How can you say that rabbinic law doesn't come from Lo Tasur? Then why do I have to listen to the rabbis? V'shilo lavar al divrehen. If there is no source, not biblical, not logical, if it was really so obviously logical, it should be biblical. As we've said in the Gemara many places, when things are so obvious, they're binding simply by logic. You don't even need a pasuk. Right? Logic is biblically binding. Tell me, oh, really? Yes, not only is it biblically binding, can something become Yeharig Val Yavor because it logically makes sense? It should be Yeharig Val Yavor?
No.
100%. It's a Gemara, right? What are the 3 Yeharig Val Yavors? The cardinal sins, things that you die, right?
Killing another person.
Good, why is murder Yeharig Val Yavor? What Pasuk tells me murder is Yeharig Val Yavor? None, it's a Svara. Me, Amar Dadama, the high. Gavra sumak tvei. The Gemara just says, and that's an edge dalit. Who says his blood is redder than someone else's? Zeu. That's the source, and it's so obviously true to the Gemara that then how do you know that rape by the Gilead riot is yarg v'liavor? Agzei reshave from murder, which means that we prove that murder is yarg v'liavor from pure logic, and then we're so convinced that it's true, we then make agzei reshave from it to. Which tells you that 2 out of 3 emerge from Svara. Only Avodah Zarah doesn't. So, if you think Svara is not important in Torah, then you're wrong. Sorry. Amad Svara akra chad dina lehen. So he says, V'hine b'yavamot af samach bed, Tanya. The Braisa tells you in Yavamot, Shloshah dvarim asa Moshe Rabbeinu alav ha-shalom mida'ato v'yiskima da'ato l'da'at ha-makom. There are 3 things that Moshe did by himself, without God telling him to, but God eventually agreed. We'll talk about this in the Gada Tashir, not this week, not next week, but the week after that. Like, the next time we have Shir, not after today, but next week is Shushan Purim, so not next week. So, yes. Purim is already on Monday night.
Do we have Yeshiva on Shushan Purim?
No. That's why I said I'm not giving Shir on Shushan Purim, because we don't have Yeshiva on Shushan Purim. We tell you, go, enjoy Purim and Yerushalayim.
Sorry, Tanis, let's do Sunday.
That's a great idea.
What?
That's a great idea.
Sunday. Enjoy a second day of Purim? Yes. Yeah. Well, not under our supervision? Yes. Just go, just enjoy.
That's not what supervision will mean to what I think.
Well, you're having Tanis, that starts Sunday or Monday?
Sunday.
Why is Sunday? Is it Purim Tuesday?
It starts Sunday night.
He separated from his wife. She bared a luchot when he broke the luchot. Behosif yom echad, and he added a day before the Torah was given.
Supposed to be 2 days, not 3.
What meaning? He made it on Zion instead of Vav, according to Chazal. The Torah was actually given on Zion. I know this is shocking, but according to the majority view in Chazal, the Torah was actually given on Zion, Sivan, not Vav.
Huh.
Yes. Why do we celebrate Shavuot and Vav? Good question. Also, not for now.
Oh, daily Chazal is doing it right then.
A good
2-day.
No, it's never doing it right. Never, because remember Shavuot doesn't have a date. Shavuot is 50 days after the first day of Pesach. Always. That's how the Torah describes it. It never gives it a date. So he says, where does all this come from? So we look at Yudzayin. He says, V'nir'eh. The most of you mechad enel mi derabbanan min Torah leita mitzvah prishar rekshnei yamim. He says what you learn from this is this is only rabbinic. Umikom makom. Second line, his schema dato ladana makom. What is the Gemara telling you? That there are cases where Moshe said something. It's only derabbanan essentially because Moshe said it, not God. But God agreed. Dechein hayagam ratzon Hashem yitbarach. This was the will of God. He just didn't get around to commanding it directly. Okay, he didn't command it directly. How about that? He didn't not get around to it. He said, this is the secret to all rabbinic law. The rabbis simply got it right. They got God's will correct. Lidugma, for example, kishasu shniot l'arayo, when they added all the rabbinic incestual relations, gam ratzon Hashem yidbarach haya kein shenigzor al atzmenu shniot. Ela shelo tzival, ze bat Torah mefurash. That's what God wanted, that these should be prohibited. He just didn't say it explicitly. And then he gives you a bunch of other examples. Skip down to Yurchet, towards the end of the page. Umehai taima anu chayavin la'asot kedivrehen. And this is why we have to follow the rabbis. Shai anu mekaimin bazer ratzon Hashem yitbarach. Because by listening to the rabbis, you're following God's will. Sheskima da'atan l'da'ato, because he agreed with them. Or they agreed, they were machavein to him. What makes them weaker than biblical law? The fact that they weren't written explicitly. And then he notes in Yotet, I'll say this outside, that even laws that are fully biblical but aren't explicit in the Torah, like Halacha Moshe Misinai, have a weaker status in certain regards.
It's actually written down.
What?
That's something that's...
That's written down. And therefore you see that there is a normative value to how much space God gives to things in the Torah.
What is halacha Moshe Sinai? That's
a tradition passed down to Moshe, which has biblical status but is weaker. And he gives an example in Chaf, and he says, "I'll tell you my proof to this, which is that the Gemara says Yafasi Chatan Shal Avdei Avot Yoter Mitoratan Shal Banim, that the conversations of the slaves of the patriarchs was more important than the Torah of their children. So the fact that all of Hilchot Shabbos is derived from like a hint, right? Because we learned that from the Mishkan. It never says that those are the Malachot. And we spend like 60 psukim telling the entire story of Eliezer and going to get Rivka and going back from getting Rivka and telling the story twice, because first the story happens and then he retells the story. So you see that the fact that the Gemara says, oh, look how impressive that is, means that the number of words that the Torah devotes has normative value. But now for our point, skip to Chaf Aleph. He writes, Ubazeh yuvan inyan satum, mashe matzinu gzeirat chachamim gam kodem matan Torah. He said, I have two things to explain from this. One is how we find the possibility of rabbinic law, according to the Gemara, even before the giving of the Torah. For example, the Akum Habal Bat Yisrael in Gzirat Beitin Shel Shem, because the Gemara says that the prohibition of a Jewish woman sleeping with a non-Jew was prohibited by the Betin of Shem, like the son of Noach. B'maaseh Yehuda V'Tamar. It's not, right? That was when it became prohibited.
Where does it say this?
Gemara or Midrash.
And how were there Jews alive that he could make that?
I don't want to get too much into this, but his point is, Umeize tam hayu chayavin al shmol de rechachamim, darei kol de matan Torah lo hayu mitzuvin ela b'shem v'matz ben enoch. Umila, uginan nasheh. How could you say that the Jews, the Bnei Yisrael, okay, not Jews, the literal children of Israel, were chayav in the rabbinic law if Lo Tasur is not one of the Sheva Mitzvah Bei Noach, and it's not Mila, and it's not Gera Nasheh. And similarly, Moshe Rabbeinu adding a day before Matan Torah. And for our purposes, three lines in the bottom of Chaf Aleph. Umamen et chayvah od nishrot v'chamim v'chein la sovrin d'chiyuvah d'rabbanan b'katan shegi'il chinuch hu'al ha'katan, and the position of Tosfot. that a child is directly obligated in chinuch. Not like Rashi sits on the father. If children aren't obligated in mitzvot, so he's also not obligated in the law of listening to the rabbis. So how can the rabbis directly obligate him? Answer for Rabbi Hanan is this thesis that he's developed from the Ramban. I can explain it well. Anything the rabbi said, we know that it's the will of God. And how are children obligated to listen to God? Well, because that's what you're created for. Everything in the world has to listen to God. This is essentially a teleological argument, right? Teleological argument, right? What? I mean, it is, right? You know you're obligated. This is what you were created to do, and therefore you should do it, right? You were created for it, so you should do it. It's what your purpose leads you to.
You can easily say just not at this stage.
And then he has this wild line. Why was he exempt from mitzvot? Because God wanted him to. But once the rabbi said it, and now we know that God wants it. So now they're obligated. Why? Because God wants it. Why didn't he want it? Now he does want it? I don't know. Don't ask me. I have no idea. But that's how he conceptually deals with it.
Sorry, who's
this? This is Rabbi Chanan Wasserman. Okay? Now, there is a third possibility, right? Which is not, it's from Lotasser, nor does it reveal God's will. There is a third sort of group. There are some possibilities, but there's a third, basically, group of possibilities, which is that we listen to rabbinic law because we accepted to listen to rabbinic law. That's what binds us. And then you got to figure out whether children can be bound to what adults accepted.
Yeah, children never accepted it.
Well, maybe they did. Maybe we accepted it as a nation. Because you didn't personally accept rabbinic law.
But our children are considered part of the nation.
Now, who says... Yes, they are. Now, who says this? Who says that it comes from acceptance? So, fundamentally, the person who says it is, most explicitly, is Rabbeinu David. Who's Rabbeinu David?
No idea.
He's a Talmud of the Ramban. He is, but his book, in general, most people know his writing. He wrote, we have his Sefer HaPesachim, and on Sanhedrin, he's quoted often by the Ran. We don't have his full commentary on Sanhedrin, but we do have certain passages that have been reprinted in the Sanhedrin Gedola series. And in it, he writes this. I'll just get you the key things. Look at the end of the top. So, like, there's three paragraphs. So look at the end. Don't be mistaken because of what it says. You know, where we obligate in rabbinic law from Latasur. That's not really the pshat. It's an asmachta, meaning we hang it on that pasuk. It's not really the chiyuv. Next paragraph. Why do we have to listen to them? Because talui b'hem, we hung ourselves on it. We depend on it. It is what it is. We accepted it. What do you want from me? Just like the halacha, that if someone accepted an isra on himself, it's usher. You can't permit it. It's like an eder. Like, we accepted it. That's why.
What does that mean? How does the nation accept this? Like,
we did. We do.
Practically, that can't be possible.
Nope, we do.
It's not possible.
Why not?
Because there was no moment where the nation at some point said, yeah, we accept this. What would have happened was some rabbi at some point
made a halacha, and that person
accepted it, and then over time, it just kind of happened. But that doesn't mean the nation accepted it. Just people figured, oh, we have to do it because that person did.
No. We accepted it. When we accepted it, how we accepted it, formal acceptance, I don't know, but we did. We do.
Torah, the rabbinical law.
What?
Torah or the
rabbinic law. But fundamentally, that's how we accepted biblical also. So it could be part of Mount Sinai,
right,
for all I know.
But that was a specific moment.
Maybe it happened then also. I don't know.
It would have been recorded somewhere.
I'm just saying what he says. And now let me show you what a very, very surprising statement. So maybe you'll tell me that's crazy. Let me show you a crazier statement that goes in this general direction. Let me ask you a question. If there's a machloket between Minhag and the Gemara, what do you follow?
Gemara.
So you'd say Gemara. The Gonim said Minhag. Why?
Torah Moshe Mizinai.
What?
It was a reason it was passed down.
Because they say like this. Why do you listen to the Gemara?
It was passed down.
Good. So according to Rav Haigon, the reason you listen to the Gemara is because we accepted to listen to the Gemara. And therefore, what's the Ikar? Minhag or the Gemara?
Minhag.
Because it's the reason that we follow the Gemara is because we agreed to. That's the Minhag. And therefore, it's a Machlok and Minhag or Bavli. You follow the Minhag. Look, I'm not making this up. Look at 9. Rav Haigo is quoted in Rav Tumim Dehim. He says, Divrei harabim hi hamochiach al kol mishnah al kol Gemara. What the majority does is what proves every mission, every Gemara. V'yoter mikol raya mizeh, greater than any proof in the Gemara is Pukhazi Mayama Davar, is the rule the Gemara says, go see what people do. Vizeha Ikar Vahasmach. This is the main point. Va'acharkach, after you look at what people do, Anumabitim Bechal Garim Shinem Ruba Gemara Benyanzeh. Then you look at the Gemara.
So then you can
1 second. And then he says, V'im Yesh, and then there's a machloket. Eino Okeret Ha'ikar. The Gemara cannot uproot the main point. He is so convinced that basically what binds us to practice, even the Gemara, is because we accepted it. And therefore, this is just taking Rabbeinu David to the extreme, which is, if rabbinic law is about acceptance, so then what really matters is what we accepted.
So then
not what it says in the text, but what we accepted. So because we only listen to the text, but we accepted it.
So then you can never change your minhag. Because then it's stronger than your halacha.
Good. According to the Gonim, it's going to be very hard to change minhag. You're right. I'm not... Minhagim is another shir for another time. But I just want to point out that there is this third direction, right? Direction 1 of the Rambam is Doraisa. Direction 2 of the Rav Elchanan with the Ramban is?
We accepted it.
No. Rav Elchanan with the Ramban is it reflects God's will. Rabbeinu David, we accept it and that's binding. The extreme of that is Rav Haigon, which says, yeah, so much so is it all about acceptance. And that's that Minhag, is, which is an actual record of what people do, is more powerful in a certain sense than what the rabbis actually said. Right now, does that mean he thinks, well, maybe you're just misunderstanding Gemara and that's how we'll save face? Maybe, I don't know. But fundamentally, that's the point. Now, again, I didn't want to get into a full share of rabbinic authority, but bringing it back to the point we were talking about is the machloket about chinuch, I wanted this just as a nafkamina. Chinuch is, well, how do you understand chinuch? So again, if you think it's on the parent, so you can justify that according to any conception of rabbinic authority. But if you think it's on the child, so if you think it comes from Lotasur, either you just say, well, that's why we go like Rashi, and it's on the father, because the kid is not chayv mitzvah. Or you do some very fancy lamdos and say, children are really chayv mitzvah, they just can't be punished, based on the Chacham Sofer and the Yehuda. But again, they don't make this extrapolation, it's just a theoretical model. Right? Or you do what Rav Elchanan says, which is, well, no, everyone's chayav to do what God says. And once the rabbis say it, it reveals God's will. So they're directly obligated because God said so. Aye, then how is it different than biblical law? Okay, there are different levels to what God wants you to do. Some is at the level of biblical, some is rabbinic. That's just the nature of things. Deal with it. And then if you think it's about acceptance, so then I don't know, right? Because on the one hand, you might say, well, they're part of the group that accepted it. And whatever they accepted, they accepted. Adult, child, who cares? It's not as formal. Or you could say, no, only at which point they become chayev in Torah can they plausibly be bound by commitments, which are, you know, I don't know, functions of vows and stuff like that. So, you know, you could go back and forth on that. But the important point is to realize that this question of can you obligate children directly requires you to have a background theory of what is the nature of rabbinic authority and can it be utilized for someone who isn't bound to the Torah. Which the Rambam, the answer is probably not. They're not definitely. According to the Rambam, obviously yes. And that's what Rav Elchanan notes.
So does the Rambam say anything about Katzon reading Megillah?
Yeah. You have the source from yesterday. I even put it on. Didn't I?
I don't recall.
I thought I did. I thought I gave you...
I'm going to get it. It's on my desk.
What?
Should I get it?
Did I give you that on mine? No, that's not true. I didn't. I gave you the Rosh from the Ritva of all students.
Yeah.
Where you have the division. I don't know. I don't think I gave you the Ramban. But I mean, it wouldn't just be about Megillah. It'd be what he says in all the Chinuch Sugyas. They have to look back what the Ramban actually says in all the Chinuch Sugyas, right? Which is, you know, it's Bracha and Sukkah and Megillah. There's a lot of places where it comes up. Kedusha. Okay.
Can you just say, like, I mean, it'd be the same idea as, I guess, saying that they're...
If I remember correctly, Ramban still holds like Rashi. Meaning you can, it's a one-way nafkamina, right? Meaning you can hold the Ramban and still say they didn't bother obligating kids, they only obligated parents. It's the other way that's more problematic.
Right.
Meaning anyone can say that it's on parents, it doesn't matter. Right. Whatever conception you have of rabbinic authority can explain how you would obligate an adult.
You can just say kids
it's only a problem if you...
You can just say kids were obligated, but there's no punishment. So therefore, it's not like the same level of obligation because kids can't be punished, but they're still obligated.
Correct.
But there's no
like obligation. I said, I've never seen someone construct that.
There's no such thing as really an obligation because then...
No, that might not be true.
But what's the difference?
No, well, that's what I said. According to the Nod Yehuda, it's just so fair, they're not punished in this world, but they are punished in Shamayim, which means that there is a level...
I mean, not even in Shamayim.
That would be hard. I can't imagine that you'd say that there's... obligated, but there's no punishment here or the next world.
Right, so it's a nice thing to do, and that's why we do it, to get them ready for it.
That I don't know.
But you can't punish them for it.
I don't know if I would buy that. I don't know. I find that hard to believe. Meaning, if there's no consequences whatsoever, right? Law usually assumes consequences. That's what law is.
Right, but that's why...
That's why I'm willing to construct an argument based on the Chassam Sofer and the Yehuda that maybe Ketanim really are Chayiv in Shamayim. It's hard for me to say they're Chayiv in Shamayim with no consequences.
But isn't it
maybe
worse...
mitigated consequences.
But isn't it worse to be Chayiv in Shamayim than here? Isn't that the...
You're Chayiv in both.
Oh, right.
What do you mean? If you say you're Chayiv...
The whole point, like...
What do you mean you're Chayiv
in... It might be even Brachos that talks about this, how the reason we have punishment here is so there's no punishment up there. Like, it's a lot worse punishment there than here. So then how can you say children are chayiv in punishment
there are
there
a lot of
and
theories.
Not here?
Part of punishment is kapara, but part of it is retributive, and sort of it is rehabilitative, you know, is rehabilitation, it's complicated.
So
also, another complicated shear, right? What is the motivation of punishment in Jewish law?
It doesn't make sense that children are punished there, not here. Here would come first. Mm-hmm. Just like Chazal says with the Meraglim. That makes more sense.
Again, I think that's the majority view. It's Maris Chiyas points out, but the Chassam Sofer is not, you know, is not a nobody, and he thinks of it that way. Again, I haven't seen anyone construct an argument based on that. I'm constructing a theoretical model based on a combination of a few possibilities. I'm not putting my name behind it. I'm just saying you could construct an argument like that. I'm not compelled. Okay,
can we do a share?